The date is the 30th of October, and this is an interview with Lieutenant General Ling by Dr. Reg Roy at the University of Victoria. Okay, Reg, you're on.
Okay, well, now, I finished with the Air Transport Command after that. I went overseas at the end of 65, so I had had nearly 4 years as commander of the Air Division, of Air Transport Command, which, of course, was a very popular post, and then never ceases to amaze me that I was fortunate enough to hold on to it as long as I did. After 1 year, people go gunning for that job because it was such an incredibly interesting position of a large command with large responsibilities, and it was as close as you were going to get to operations, certainly under peacetime conditions, short of war. So it was a very popular position. Anyway, finish that.
Well, before you finish, just one small question. You mentioned at one time that you went on a trip, a long trip, with Mr. Pearson.
Right.
Mr. Pearson.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I was just wondering, in the subsequent years, did you ever have occasion to go, to accompany any other VIPs, any other prime ministers, the King, the Queen, Prince Philip, or what have you?
No, I didn't. That was the one and only time. What happened, of course, I was at the right rank at the right time of Pearson's visit. Then I was promoted to Air Commodore. Normally we used to send a wing commander or a group captain along accompanying anybody of that ilk. You get any higher and it begins to get pretty, pretty dicey. So I was lucky to get that one in, but from there on in, really my rank was too high to go along with anybody. Although, of course, I met many of them. We had many visitors, and coming through Trenton, there were occasions where I was coming up to Ottawa to meet people, but I was never traveling with people, just meeting them.
Mm-hmm.
So, the answer to your question is no.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Right.
No.
Now, you get out of Air Transport Command, what date?
It was in December of 65 when I was transferred to become the chief of staff of the Air Division at Metz in France, number one Air Division, with the understanding that I would be taking over the Air Division that's coming summer when Doug Bradshaw, who was the commander of the Air Division, was due to retire age. So and the idea for me to go over that roughly 6 to 8 months early was to find out what it was all about, and more specifically to find out about nuclear weapons, because the Air Division at that time was in the nuclear strike role. And it was very important that the commander not only understand what it was all about, but see how it operated and what have you, because you were now dealing with in a weapons system that was controlled by the United States, and they were pretty sticky about people who were put into command positions without having some real background knowledge on what it was all about. So I went over, well, at least we and the family went over. We left Trenton at the end of December. It was rather a difficult time for us because our youngest, David at that time, was just about a year old, just over a year, and he got a terrible infection in his throat. And we very nearly lost him. He was in hospital for, I guess 2 to 3 weeks. And it just happened to coincide with all our farewells and when we were leaving Trenton and getting packed up or getting our stuff into storage, really, deciding what we wanted to take over to Europe with us. And the last thing I did after the final farewell parade, I hopped in the staff car and went to the hospital to get David out of the hospital to then take him right on board the airplane. We were that close. And the doctor at that time said that if we had not been going overseas, there would be no question of him leaving hospital. And as soon as we got to Europe, I was to contact the MO at Metz. And he gave me, of course, all the background on David, the medical background, so that the MO would know what had happened, which, of course, we did. And when we arrived there, and the MO said, okay, well, keep him at home. He's obviously on the mend, and we'll just keep an eye on him. And as it turned out, he came along fine. But it was a very trying time for Barbara to have him in, and very seriously ill. I mean seriously ill. During this period when here we were trying to break from one job and move over to another, and I had been very busy traveling around the command, visiting the units and so forth, making my farewell swan.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a difficult time. However, we got on board the airplane and away we went to arrive at Marville, where we were met by the protocol officer, and then taken immediately by car to Metz, which, as I recall, was a drive of about an hour and a half, 2 hours, and into the chief's of staff quarters at Metz, which was a furnished home, as were all the PMQs, so the public married quarters in France and in Germany were all furnished.
Yeah.
And so that all you took with you were your personal things. We did take sheets and that linen, and you took your cut, your flatware, and that sort of thing. But that was just about all you need. They were equipped. You really didn't need to take a darn thing if you didn't want to, but people like to have their own personal things, and so that's what we did. So it was a simple matter of literally getting there, and it had been an overnight trip in a Yukon, a long trip, and with David, who had been very, very restless on the trip. When we got there, we more or less all flaked out and got some sleep. Well, from there on, I spent the next... the headquarters of one air division at that time was in a chateau just outside Metz, actually. It was in the country. It was quite a large building, Chateau de Mercy, that had been taken over, I suppose, when the air division first came into being as the headquarters. I'm sorry, I should qualify that a wee bit. I think the Air Division originally was formed down in Paris or something like that, and then moved very quickly after it began to build up after the NATO decision, or was accepted that we would become a part of NATO. And as soon as it became an Air Division, the headquarters moved up to the Chateau de Mercy in France. Well, this delightful old chateau, it really was a delightful old building. It reminded me somewhat of the headquarters of Sixth Group up in Yorkshire, where we were in not a great big stately mansion during World War II. Whereas the accommodation, the living accommodation, was right on the edge of Metz itself. In other words, we were within the boundaries of the city of Metz. And the government had taken over quite a bit of property and put up single homes for the senior staff and apartment buildings for everyone else. So there was an area, a concentrated area of Canadians, right on the edge, right in the city of Metz. Well, I spent the first few months really catching up with this change in role for me, finding out about the strike role, the nuclear role, and also the photo reconnaissance role. The Air Division was just beginning to get into the photo reconnaissance role using the 104s, and when I arrived, we were reduced to the three bases, that is, Marville, Grosse-Tonquin, and Baden-Solingen. The original fourth base, which was in France, had already closed, so there was just the three bases. We had the Air Division Hospital was at Zweibrücken, whereas Marville became our terminal, our air transport terminal, if you will, for the transatlantic work. And by this time, of course, the whole system of moving everybody by air was now flowing properly. The Yukon was operating properly. We'd now gotten that the engine, the Rolls-Royce engine, up to where it was lasting something like closer to 1,000 hours now before it was failed or we had to pull it. So things were beginning to operate much, much more smoothly. Well, the role, particularly the strike role, was an incredibly fascinating one. The weapons, the actual bombs themselves, were of course all in weapons, special weapons storage sites on the wings, where we had that role, and the two wings that were involved were both Zweibrücken and Baden-Sonnigen. Marvel had it had been decided that it would be the photo reconnaissance wing, so they didn't have any special weapons, any nuclear weapons there.
These would be buried underground and all that.
Yes, they were proper storage sites, and of course the great thing about nuclear weapons was security. The number of people required in the air division just for security, for actual guarding of the weapons, was large. You had to have, and the organization was quite complex too. And all controlled by American regulations. The fact that we were using them, and we were charged with protecting those weapons. Custody, and I'll get into this in a few minutes, but custody was a different thing. That was still an American responsibility. But we had to have enough people to provide security so that if there was any attempt to raid one of our storage sites, that there would be enough people to put up a damn good fight. And of course the great concern, as it is still a great concern, is some group such as the German Waffen-Gang or the Red Brigade in Italy or some organized group who would be have enough people to take a crack at it. And if they were properly armed and it was well planned, they could put up, they would have a chance of getting inside the compound. So the point was that you had to have a system that would fight that kind of thing. And I suppose we were prepared to take on at least a company of well-trained troops in defending the sites. Enough to put up a delaying action, if you will, until the rest of the base could be mobilized. And there was not just the immediate security people, but the whole base could be called on, if needs be, as a backup to provide the firepower required to protect or prevent somebody from stealing one of those weapons. Now, the weapons, you hear people talk about, stealing weapons and all that sort of nonsense. Well, you have to take that with an enormous grain of salt. Anybody who thought they could walk in and just tuck one of those bombs under their arms and walk out with it, of course, had another thought coming. They were big. They were not something you could just pick up with one hand. You had to have the proper lifting devices to handle them. They were heavy, and you'd then have to have a vehicle. You just simply couldn't run off with one. The point that somebody, and it had been made several times, that, oh dear, these weapons are around and some nut someday is going to go in and walk off with one, is just so much baloney. It just isn't. Doesn't work that way. However, an organized attack was something quite different. So that was part of the operational program on the base and was exercised like anything else. Well, the weapons, the other aspect of the weapons, and this is where I come to custody. The weapons were actually contained in a special storage site, where under American control. Now, while we provided the bulk of the guards, the Americans had a small detachment with officers and sufficient. They had officers in charge and sufficient troops that there was always an American soldier, or USAF man, actually, heavily armed, who would be they're present all the time to prevent his Canadian counterpart from ever doing something that he shouldn't do. And the actual weapons themselves were under an American lock and key and could only be released to us, to the Canadians, from that special storage under special lock and key when a code word was passed down through the net to the officer in charge, the American officer in charge, and he had to have the right challenge and then had the right response, and it went back and forth like a tennis ball until it was all agreed. Yes, nobody was pulling a fast one on the line, and there was a backup system to confirm this on teletype as well, a secure teletype system. All that which happened, of course, very quickly. Then the officer in charge, who was a major, had the authority to release weapons to us. Now, this was done, and weapons were actually released to us under certain exercise conditions, and I'll get into that later on. But the control, the actual custody of the weapons, was entirely in American hands.
But this ultimate control that you mentioned, once this American officer received his instructions and had his instructions confirmed, it was a matter of him, shall we say, of unlocking the door.
That is right.
And there were the weapons.
There were the weapons. That is right. And enough Canadians, and the Canadians then were allowed to put their hands on them
and away they go.
Get them out. That's right.
And they were ready to go.
And they were ready to go, yes. I should say that the authority his authority to release, that is the American major's authority to release, came down the chain right from Sakur, wearing his American hat as commander-in-chief of American forces in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And the authority came all the way down an American chain, not down a NATO net,
mm-hmm.
although Sakur wore the two hats. He was head of the Americans in Europe, and he was also Supreme Allied Commander of Europe for NATO.
Yeah.
And, of course, he got his release authority directly from the Chief of Staff in Washington, who in turn got it from the President.
Yeah.
So that was the chain. And it was all American. And no one else was in on that net at all the way down. So the Americans had quite a communications system for just for control of nuclear weapons in Europe, much less their own operational command and control system. And similarly, all the maintenance done on the weapons that could be done and was done up until some sort of an inspection cycle was required when the weapon had to be flown out. All the maintenance was done in this special storage site. They had a proper workshop where they could do what I suppose could be described as first-line maintenance on the weapons. And then, of course, if anything, through their testing, and we were never allowed to watch the maintenance work on these things. This was all done behind locked doors. If a weapon required to be sent out for an overhaul, then airplanes were flown in, United States Air Force airplanes, transport planes were flown in, and the weapon or weapons, as the case may be, were loaded on the airplane and then flown out to wherever their depot for overhaul was, probably back in the United States. But we, that was, I mean, taking the time to explain that system because it has been a bit of a political nut.
Yeah.
But it was very important that as the President was the only one who had the authority to release America and to release nuclear weapons, even to the United States forces, it was equally important that it would apply to the Canadian forces and anyone else who had nuclear weapons that were United States weapons. So, that was just the control bit. Now, of course, the operational use of the weapons was related to the targeting. And in Europe, the targeting, which I assume is still prevails, or the same general concept still prevails, targeting was of a tactical nature. We're not talking about strategic bombing or the use of nuclear weapons, which is really within the purview of SAC, plus whatever, and the U.S. Navy, with whatever missiles they have, plus airplanes. We had the 104s, and in Europe, we are really talking of a tactical application of these weapons. Well, Sakur, of course, in his planning, had different priorities for targets. So you had different applications. For example, if there was known that there was an important communications center through which USSR or the Warsaw Pact would have to move a lot of their forces, then obviously it would become a target to be taken out to just to prevent forward movement. Airfields were obvious targets because of the large superiority of the Warsaw Pact in aircraft over NATO. Then I'm really talking about pre-planned targets as opposed to targets of opportunity, which would obviously develop if a battle broke out. But those targets of opportunity were kind of kept in reserve because no one knew what would happen in an attack and what would become a target and what would not. But to prevent, or as a part of the deterrent, it was known that there was a wallop of tactical weapons in Europe which, in the event of hostilities, would be released and against various types of targets in accordance with a priority system laid down by Sakur and his target planners. And this was all related to the strategy of preventing or of defending against an attack from the Warsaw Pact. So that the actual targeting was allocated to the air division, came down the net then from Sakur through the headquarters down through 4th ATAF. And 4th ATAF was the immediate superior headquarters, operational headquarters to the number one air division. So the targeting came all the way down the line, and then we were given our targets. And then, with the weapons and with the targets, it was now up to us to do the job if and when the button was ever pushed. And that was to get to that target and drop the bomb. It was literally as simple as that in terms of concept. To get there, though, we, as I suppose all the Allied forces in Europe did, realized that with the air defenses that were available to the Warsaw Pact, that it was absolutely essential to operate right on the ground. And by that I mean within 50 feet on the ground.
Yeah.
And, of course, to travel supersonic. And this is where the 104 was such an ideal aircraft for this, for that role. It had the load-carrying capacity required, but it had the terrific speed that was needed to carry that weapon and travel at supersonic speed. Because it didn't take us long, all this had been done. I don't mean to imply that I uncovered all this, but this is the sort of information that came out to me as I was going through all my training.
Mm-hmm.
You take any Soviet armored division, it had more bloody anti-aircraft weapons than I think the rest of NATO had in Europe, heavily armed with anti-aircraft weapons. And the chances of getting across an armored division, even at ordinary speeds, even at 50 feet, would be pretty remote. The chances of being shot down would be very, very good indeed.
Mm-hmm.
But at supersonic speed, you'd have a good chance because you were traveling so darn fast. But you had to be right on the deck and basically contour flying. So all of our navigation training was devoted to being able to fly on the deck day or night, basically in all weather, and still arrive at your target. So we needed a damn good navigation system, and there was one in the 104, a damn good inertial navigation system, that when you're traveling at those speeds, it doesn't take very long to get where you want to go. And although some of our targets were given some of the extreme targets, extreme range targets, to the point where the chances of one or two of our people getting back were pretty remote. It was almost a one-way mission type of thing. But the concept was supersonic on the deck, and hoping in that way to get through the defenses and to the target to deliver the weapon, and then, of course, get back home. The other third part of that was the actual bombing accuracy. While we were talking about nuclear weapons, they still demanded accuracy as to where that weapon was going to actually explode or detonate. So, from a training point of view, we had, I suppose, really the three basic components. One was the target, and each of the pilots was allocated a target with a secondary target, and some of them with a third target. But he had to study that target, and he had to know it by like the palm of his hand. And he actually was given the folio, the target folio, which had all the information in it. He had to have a route, the navigation. So he had to know the navigation to get from base to that target in all kinds of weather, night or day. Then he had to, and the way that was practiced was by doing cross countries,
mm-hmm.
low-level practice cross countries, not supersonic. That was the only thing that we didn't do was supersonic flying. Because of the damage that would be done, when it was done at a very high Mach number. And then bombing accuracy. So our training consisted of, and I'm excluding here the normal training that goes on with emergency procedures and letdowns and the straight instrument flying, if you will. We insisted that a pilot keep up, because this is the way you save lives when the weather gets bad. Aside from that normal flying, they would do cross-country flights, which would simulate the route they would actually fly to get to their allotted target. And it would be over terrain, near cities. It would be laid on so that it would be almost as close as we could make it to be the duplicate of the trip he would do to get to his target, except this would be all flown over France and Germany.
Well, in a case like that, I would assume, and especially since it's a training flight, that the people undergoing the exercise wouldn't necessarily be leaving from your or from the Canadian air base all the time.
Well, everybody was doing the same thing, and this business of air traffic control in Europe became a real problem. No, we, our people would do it from our base and would fly the route, but God, there'd probably be a 500 or 600 other airplanes doing the same thing over that very confined airspace of Germany and France. And it did become a problem, and it was all on the deck. So that Jesus, you know, and the people were complaining terribly because even farmers out in the field, and all of a sudden, wham, a 104 comes over. Well, mind you, we were a little higher. We were flying at about 200 feet, but even so, you know, it's...
what a surprise.
You're damn right. And if you've ever had a 104 come over you, even subsonic, at that kind of altitude, Jesus, it puts a fear of God into you. It really does.
Yeah.
With winding up, when it was possible to get to work with a range, one of the bombing ranges, the route would wind up with the actual delivery of a practice weapon, a practice bomb, on one of the ranges in Europe. If it was not possible to coincide, because the ranges were at a premium, there were very few of them, and everybody had to use the few ranges, all countries had to use the few ranges that were possible, so getting time was very difficult. The ranges were going flat out all day long. And, or at nighttime too. Literally, they were almost going around the clock.
That place would be worth mining.
all the metal, yeah. But if we couldn't do that, then of course, when we did get our allocation of time on a bombing range, then of course, instead of across country, it would be a straightforward matter of staggering airplane to arrive over the range at a given time and go through their bombing runs and then return to base, and in that way practice, which was the other thing, of course, that was necessary, but the constant practice, bombing accuracy as such. Mm-hmm. Bombing accuracy became a big thing in the exercises, as I shall relate. Well, that was, in a nutshell, that was a nuclear war, and I shall walk through an exercise to show you how the whole thing worked, because this is where it becomes fascinating. Everything comes together.
Mm.
Now, on the recce roll, we were just getting into the recce roll when I arrived in the air division, getting the equipment, getting our people trained, and it was a brand new role for us. We hadn't done photo reconnaissance since the war. We'd done a lot of photo work in the north, that sort of thing. We'd had quite a bit of experience with cameras and development and all that sort of stuff as a result of all the work that we'd done in Air Transport Command. Post-war, of photographing the north and helping with the mapping of the country. But we hadn't done any real tactical photography since World War II. There'd been a couple of stabs at it with our reserves and so forth, but this is really World War II equipment and wasn't really up to speed with what we are now into. So that we had to start from square one. And so Marville, the wing at Marville, really started, as I say, right from square one, developing the procedures, the techniques of carrying out photo reconnaissance. Now, the important thing with photo reconnaissance, again, as it was with the bombing role, was navigation. You were told to go and photograph something, and you had to find the damn thing. But now it becomes even more difficult, or if there is a comparison between the nuclear role and the photo role. In the nuclear role, you had a target, and the target more or less would either be, certainly those pre-planned ones, a city, an airfield, a crossroads, or a marshalling yard, something that would be easily identifiable. But the photo business was more of a tactical nature, and more often than not was something that could be out in some field somewhere. And so you had to find the right field and then photograph it. And so their technique was, instead of putting, say, a division out or a brigade of armor or whatever, they would put one vehicle out under some trees or something like that on the side of a road and say, now there is the target, go find it and bring back photographs. In other words, making it much, much more complicated than would actually be the fact. But the whole point was to find the field. And that, when you're traveling subsonic, or as would be the case, you'd travel subsonic to get under and fire, and then you'd go supersonic. So your navigation had to be just fabulous to get to that field and not miss it.
Are we talking about a one-man plane?
We're talking about a one-man plane. Yes, a one-man plane. Yes, yes, absolutely. But again, the inertial navigation system helped enormously. But here, whereas the nuclear boy had his target folio and the routes and everything, and he could study so that he knew exactly what he was going to do, the photo recce boy, his was constantly being changing. Was constantly being changed, and he had no idea where the hell he was going to go.
Yeah.
So he had to sit down and plan and study his route just before takeoff. He was given his target, he had to work out his route, sit down and figure out where he was going to go, what pinpoints were there to make sure he was accurate, and then the field that he was looking for, and he may or may not have had a photo to work with. Probably not. He had to work off a 1 over 2500 map or something like that. It was the best that they could provide him with. So it became quite tricky. And initially, as could be expected, the boys had a hell of a time. They really did. No matter how we trained, we just didn't seem to be able to do it properly. But of course, it was a learning curve, and as we progressed, so our time went on. So of course, we improved. Now, the other final training bit, or from an operational point of view, was that all the people had to take exams, and more specific, the tougher exam was for the nuclear carrying strike boys, the bomber boys. They had to, let's see, if I remember correctly, it was once a year, or was it once every 6 months. They had to take an extremely tough test that on their target, the nuclear weapon, all sorts of information that they had to have up in their head, and it was all related to their job they had to perform, and it was about a two-hour exam, and it was a toughie, and it was flat out. It wasn't a question of time to think about it. It was right hard for 2 hours. And you had to have a 90% pass on the damn thing. So
was this a written exam?
Written exam, yes, all written. Yeah. All written, yeah, yeah. And it had to be, and you had to have a 90% pass. You had to pass with a 90% mark. Or if you failed, then you were taken off the strike roll. You literally were taken off, sent back to training. Because you were not up to par. You were not up to the standard required to do the job. So that testing bit made sure that the people were up to speed all the time. Aside from their flying, they had to. There was an absolute test of their ability to get off and get to their target and knew what they were doing. It was tough, and the boys used to sweat that exam out every time. No matter how good they were, the lads used to dread that damn exam because they never knew when some curves were going to be thrown at them that might just make that small percentage point pass difference, and they would be relegated to the training role until they had studied and then be retested and brought back up again. I can say that it was during the whole time I had the air division, and the 2.5 years I was there, I only remember 2 or 3 cases of lads who failed, which was indicative of the caliber of the people again. They took their job very, very seriously. They worked hard. They studied hard. And so that when the exams came up, while they were always concerned, it was the exception, a rare exception, when we didn't have 100% pass through for the whole of the wing that was being tested at that time, all the pilots. And more often than not, our marks were up in the 98-99% mark. In other words, it was not just a question of a pass, it was almost perfect papers.
Yeah. Can you give me some idea, Reg, of the sort of question, of the sort of, or sort of written question, that a pilot might be...
Obviously, they had to know a lot about the weapon, and the technical aspects of the weapon, which they were briefed on a very highly classified basis. They had to have their navigation. They had to know their navigation absolutely inside out. Really, what it boiled down to was that although they had all their portfolio and target portfolio and all,